Hello and a very warm welcome to Bruegel's live podcast, The Sound of Economics. My name is Gunther Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel. And today I'm really, really pleased and honored to host Beata Jaroczyk, the chief economist of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. Beata, thank you so much for joining us and a very warm welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Gunther. It's a pleasure to be joining you.
Thanks. So we want to talk today about the war in Ukraine and what it means for the global economy and what are the various channels, how the war affects our global economy, but also, of course, more the region. And Beata is, I think, the best qualified person to really talk about this because she has just released and just worked very intensively at the EBRD on detailed scenarios, forecasts of the various channels and the situation. And we want to hear from her and engage in a conversation with her. But we also do want to hear from you, our dear audience, and give some questions, pass on some questions to Beata. So if you want to join the conversation, please go on Slido with the code CEE, so Central and Eastern Europe, CEE. And then you can really type your questions and I will see them here on my mobile phone and we'll be able to pass on some questions to Beata. So thanks again for joining, Beata. And let's perhaps talk, perhaps start with a bigger overview. I mean, the war has been, of course, a big geopolitical shock in many respects. It has been a big energy shock. And a large part of the discussion is, of course, on energy and of the economic discussions. But I think you are pointing out that there are many channels beyond the energy channel. And I think we are not doing justice the complexity of the topic if we just talk about the energy issues. So why don't you give us a sort of broad overview on where you see the main channels and, you know, how do you assess those channels? And then we want to zoom in on the various aspects, for example, the food prices, remittances, trade finances, just to give a few teaser buzzwords already. But why don't you kick us off with a broader overview?
So thank you, Gunther. So first of all, it's worth pointing out that the war started at the point where the economy has not fully recovered from COVID, but yet growth was already slowing down. And I think it's fair to say that the economic implications of this war have already been felt around the world. This war is putting brakes on economic growth. And even if it stopped today, we would feel its implication next year. And there are many channels through which the war works, and various parts of the globe are affected through different channels. We have obviously the energy channel, we have the agricultural commodity channel, we have higher prices of non-agricultural commodities. All these three channels are fueling inflation and have implications for public finances as well as external balances, so BOP. There are channels working through remittances, refugees, tourism, as well as general uncertainty that particularly affects the region, but obviously also affects the whole economy and has implications for international flows of capital. And then, you know, one can also think about how the war and the resulting geopolitical tensions are drawing attention of investors to political risks and how that changes compensation that investors expect when they put their money in into emerging markets. So lots of channels to unpack.
Yes, indeed. So lots of different channels. So perhaps we want to understand a bit these various channels. But I guess my first question would be, which of those channels do you think is the one that needs to deserve the biggest attention when thinking about implications for the global economy? I mean, it's probably the energy one, but what's your ranking? I mean, what's your number two, so to speak?
So you can think of, I would say inflation is my number one, working through commodity prices, various types of commodities. My number two is uncertainty. My number three would be cost of capital, so interest rates. And that has implications for particularly on economies that have already been vulnerable in terms of debt sustainability. And then there are channels working through, future of globalization. You know, Janet Yellen talks a lot about friendshoring. And indeed, the idea of friendshoring, meaning trading with primarily with political allies, goes forward, that can have really long-term implications for growth in various parts of the world.
All right. So let's talk about perhaps those in the order. I mean, the inflation point, I guess, is relatively obvious. So commodity prices, and in particular energy prices, have gone up dramatically. And are now increasingly feeding into second round effects in terms of wage setting and other price setting in our economies. Not yet fully, but it's starting to be visible. How worried should we be about the inflation channel? And what do you see in terms of policy action for the central banks in particular? I mean, usually, when you have a commodity price shock, you want to see through it as a central bank because this is sort of a one-off shock, ideally. But now it's been a while that this has been on a rising trend and might well last longer than we think. And so at some stage, central banks will also be forced to act. So how do you see this inflation commodity price channel and the implications for policymakers?
So first, I think it's important to point out that higher prices of energy and higher prices of food are affecting people in emerging markets to a large extent. An average German household spends 7% of its income on utility bills. An average household in Croatia, 20%. An average household in Romania spends a quarter of its income on utility bills. And differences are for share of food in expenditure baskets are similar. So Central Eastern Europe and other emerging markets are hit harder. They are also different because, you know, anybody who is over 50 in Eastern Europe remembers the hyperinflation of the 90s. This matters because if you have experienced a moderate inflation in your lifetime, you tend to forget the experience. However, if you have experienced hyperinflation, this memory stays with you. And that means that in emerging markets, people are quicker to adjust their inflationary expectations. So that means that fighting inflation will be harder. On top of that, you have a situation where you have younger central banks that had less time to establish their reputation. The fact that inflationary expectations have already been detached from the inflation target in the presence of central banks with less cemented reputation makes emerging markets more vulnerable. Now, the implications of inflation are also spilling into government finances. And they are spilling into government finances because governments are reacting to inflation by, for instance, temporarily suspending taxes on fuel, or, for instance, in Poland, suspending VAT on food since between February and July. I don't know how much it is going to help inflation, but I know that it's going to be very costly for government coffers in a situation where government finances have already been strained by COVID.
So I mean, on this point, if I can push you on this point, it's very popular among politicians, of course, to try to reduce the impact of higher energy prices by reducing VAT or other direct taxes on those goods. However, given the strategic situation we are in, we of course want to reduce demand for these supplies, and the high prices are actually a useful signal to adjust and reduce demand for both energy and food. And in particular for energy, it is extremely important that the high prices, the signal of the high prices, is being used as a coordination mechanism to drive down demand for Russian fossil fuels, to increase essentially our strategic options vis-a-vis Vladimir Putin. So shouldn't the right policy response be here, instead of cutting VAT or cutting taxes on those goods directly, be lump sum transfers to the poor households, so that they can at least compensate part of the higher bill with the additional revenue, but also have an incentive to move away from these energy intensive goods?
You are absolutely right. This should be our response. So we know clearly that poorer households spend a higher share of their income on necessities, heating and food. We know that this share, or this relationship between income and how much you need to spend on energy and food, is steeper in emerging markets. But it also exists in advanced economies. So you're absolutely right that instead of having blanket suspension of VAT or excise taxes, we should be making transfers to protect poor households. But of course, blanket suspensions of taxes are more politically popular. But you are absolutely right in pointing out that, you know, we are here inconsistent, because on the one hand, we are talking about the need for decarbonization, which obviously requires changes to relative prices. And these changes are happening. Natural gas, right, and oil are so high, prices are so high, so naturally this should give people incentives to save. And yet governments shy away from allowing households to bear the full burden of those higher prices. So we are actually right.
Well, I mean, we are not only talking about decarbonization, but we are also, of course, talking about reducing our import dependency from Russia, and also there the price signal is of course very, very useful. But let me push you a bit on the food issue, and I've seen that you were quite strong in your public messages also on food and the higher food prices and what they mean for. I think poorer economies, where I think you have already pointed out that poorer economies typically spend a larger proportion of their income on food. What's your analysis of the food shortage situation? I mean, we are hearing 20% or so of the agricultural land in Ukraine might not be delivering this year, because basically nothing is planted at this stage. But can you give us a bit of a sense where the food situation is and how big the effect will be, not just in Central and Eastern Europe, but also in the Middle East and poorer countries such as Egypt?
This is a very important issue. So let me start by reminding everyone that Russia and Ukraine account for 30% of global wheat exports. Now, wheat is grown in the part of Ukraine where the military activities are at its most intense. The previous harvest has not been fully exported yet because shipping through the Black Sea has been blocked. Essentially, it's not happening there. Some exports are happening via railways, but the full crop has not been exported. People forget that Ukraine is also one of the top four exporters of corn and is responsible for a third of global exports of sunflower seed oil. So it's not just wheat, it's also these other commodities. As you mentioned, now farmers should be planting and sowing seeds. This is not happening to the extent it should be happening because of military activities, because of shortage of fuel, and because of access to financing that they need to purchase seeds. Now, even if part of the area is planted, it's also unclear how easy it will be to transport, to export the harvest because of blockage of Black Sea. On top of that, the fact that Russia and Belarus are very important exporters of fertilizer inputs, Belarus exports potash, Russia ammonia, means that suddenly we see huge increases in prices of fertilizers. And you'll hear farmers from Sri Lanka up to the United States complaining. And that may translate in lower yields in other parts of the world. Now, what that means is a very difficult situation for emerging markets. A lot of attention has been focused on North Africa, Middle East, where countries such as Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, import huge quantities of wheat from Russia and Ukraine. Of course, wheat is a commodity. You can import it from somewhere else, but what matters is the price. And the prices are pretty close in inflation-adjusted terms to where we saw them in 2008. And that was the time of riots in 40 countries. Now, in a country like Egypt, 60% of people, so more than half of the people, have access to bread at subsidized rates. So suddenly, as the global prices of wheat are increasing, the cost of subsidies has become much more of a burden to the government. And it's also a burden in terms of foreign exchange. A country like Egypt has a structural current account deficit. So suddenly, you find yourself in a less comfortable situation where your foreign currency reserves are sufficient to cover about only a year of your international obligations. Now, that means that countries may be resorting to some unconventional measures. So, for instance, Egypt has recently required all importers to use letters of credit in order to import. Now, letters of credit are financial instruments that provide insurance to the both sides of the transaction. But from the government perspective, making such a requirement means that you can closely monitor imports because you can closely monitor issuance of these instruments. And perhaps, if need be, you could slow down imports.
Yes, quite a dramatic situation, in fact, on the food front, and in particular the fertilizer issue with its consequence on global production. So beyond the regional production is something to really worry about. And I think quite shocking that you mentioned that food prices are close to the 2008 period where we saw riots. So if that is an indicator for future riots, I mean, it cannot be excluded that this year will be actually quite complicated politically in some of those poorer countries where a lot of young people without jobs and perhaps with not much access to to good food will come increasingly under pressure. And so this is quite a worrying perspective.
So governments are facing this very unattractive choice, right? They can either continue subsidizing basic products. So here, just to be fair, wheat prices are very high. Prices of other agricultural commodities have not risen quite that much. But, you know, in North Africa, wheat is a staple. So as a government, you have this unattractive choice of shelling out so much money to keep the subsidies going or risking political instability. And now, if you are spending money on subsidies, you need to worry about, you need to presumably become more indebted. And that's already happening in a situation where the cost of servicing government debt or public debt in Egypt reaches 9% of GDP. So it's quite a big burden. And this is happening, during the time when we can expect global interest rates to increase further. You know, when I think about countries where the EBRD operates, during the pandemic, we have been looking at the cost of borrowing. And, you know, I kept on reporting to our board that our countries of operations have access to foreign borrowing at rates that were lower 5 or 10 years before the pandemic. The situation is reversing now. During the month of March, we saw a big increase in yields on 5-year government bonds. And I would expect that as these geopolitical uncertainties continue, investors will be requiring higher compensation for political risk. So the cost of borrowing may increase.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk a bit about, so we talked about, I think, various channels, but let's also talk about some key economies. And I do want to hear from you about your assessment of Ukraine and Russia. Of course, the two key players here. And perhaps we start with a quick point on Russia. I mean, we have a sanctions regime in place. Russia is benefiting from higher energy prices that compensates for quite a bit, but still you are forecasting a recession in Russia. And perhaps you can just give us a few bullet points on where do you see the Russian economy immediately, but also how do you see the growth prospects given under a scenario where sanctions, in particular sanctions against technological exports to Russia and technological products, are sustained?
So we are projecting a drop in Russian GDP at the level of minus 10%. Now, some commentators are disappointed that this is not a big enough drop, that they were hoping for a bigger crisis. But to put it into perspective, remember that at the height of the COVID crisis, this was the kind of recession Western Europe experienced. So minus 10%, this is a very substantial recession. Of course, the Russian economy has prepared itself, has sanction-proofed itself. Russia pursued very conservative policy prior to the invasion of Ukraine. It was fighting inflation very decisively. The Russian Central Bank raised interest rates quite aggressively last summer. They were quite prudent when it came to public finances and so on and so forth. Now, even though Russia will face a recession this year as a result of various sanctions, the true cost of sanctions to the Russian economy will be felt long term. And it will be felt through lower exchange in terms of trade, in terms of foreign direct investment, in terms of flows of knowledge, because that's really what fuels economic growth. Global economy is an essential resource that countries can tap in order to bring knowledge. This knowledge can take the form of technology embodied in capital goods. It can take the form of management skills brought by foreign direct investors. And the current situation, and particularly the talk of nationalization of foreign assets in Russia, will mean that investors, even in the absence of sanctions, will think longer and hard before investing in Russia again. On top of that, there is emigration. There are highly skilled Russians leaving the country, and there are fewer links that are taking place and will be taking place between scientists, students. And I think the importance of those links as a channel of knowledge transfer should not be underappreciated. So the cost will be long-term, but it is the cost in terms of not what happens, but in terms of what will not happen, in terms of all the knowledge that would have flown to Russia that now will remain outside of its.
Right. And as you mentioned, I mean, a lot of firms are leaving Russia. I mean, we have a list of firms that goes in the hundreds now that have already left, big multinational firms that have already left Russia. That means, of course, organizational knowledge, technological knowledge, management knowledge, all of that will be gone. So certainly the medium-term impact and long-term impact on the Russian economy is quite bleak, but that doesn't mean that, of course, short-term change will happen. So this is always a tricky question. And I think the key revenue for Russia at the moment remains fossil fuels. And at the high prices, of course, Russia still makes a lot of revenues, allowing the Russian state to fund its government activities, its military, its police apparatus, security apparatus, and so on. So the fossil fuel energy exports is I think a big issue. And I mean, we have one question, and perhaps we are already starting to bring in some questions. I mean, one question is about sort of the renewables, right? And the renewable energy transition, how quickly we will be able to switch. And I have to say, I want to push a bit the point really about how important it is to move away from fossil fuels, not just for climate reasons, but really for the effectiveness of any sanctions regime on fossil fuel. Because any sanction regime on fossil fuel, if it is only working short term, is not going to make such a big difference, because Russia will be able to export gas and oil in a few years to other destinations. So we'll be able to borrow also, given that it has this valuable asset that will be interesting to sell to many other destinations in the medium term. So I think an effective sanctions regime really needs to not only focus on the short term sanction effects, but really try to influence the global demand for fossil fuels in the medium term by essentially accelerating the green transition. So what's your take on that? I mean, do you want to say a few words about the renewable side? And after that, I promise we will go to Ukraine, because there are already lots of questions on Ukraine also.
Absolutely. So first, it's worth pointing out that the Russian government budget is balanced when the oil price is at $44 a barrel, right? And currently, oil prices are much higher than that. But what's quite interesting is that we are seeing divergence in prices between Brent and Urals. So Russian oil is seeing some of the effect of sanctions, its price going down. But you are absolutely right that sanctions will not be effective unless Europe diversifies, or the Western world diversifies its energy sources and diversifies them not just geographically, but also in terms of what energy sources we use. And second, unless we induce other countries to do that. A very simple case in point is natural gas. Global capacity to trade natural gas is limited by infrastructure. Europe imports about 155 billion cubic meters a year. This year, we are getting some natural gas from the US, but we are getting, I believe, 15 billion cubic meters, which is a tenth of what Europe needs. So it's a drop in this ocean of needs. Should Europe buy more from other countries, that means that there will be less left for somebody else to buy. And therefore, those other countries, those other emerging markets, may have an incentive to make greater purchases from Russia. So what we need for the sanctions to work is a global push towards renewables. Because if Europe just sucks the supply of LNG, and other countries don't have access to LNG, they may lock themselves into coal, for instance, for the next decade. So this is a very important point. Now, there are different things one can do to speed up renewable transition, but I'm hopeful that, one of the things that will happen is speeding up issuance of permits, speeding up procedures that are needed in order to set up renewable energy facilities. Because a lot of times these procedures are quite slow, and that delays our ability, particularly in Western democracies, to invest more in renewables. And then, of course, there's huge potential for renewables in emerging markets. Think about North Africa, for instance. In Egypt, EBRD co-invested in the largest solar farm on the African continent. So there is a lot of potential there. Obviously, adjustments to the grid need to be made. So the hope is that this conflict will speed up these investments.
Okay, let's talk a bit about Ukraine. So we have many different questions already about Ukraine, but I think I want to start from a general question, which is really about the impact on the Ukrainian economy itself of the war in Ukraine, Russia's attack and war in Ukraine. How much does it affect GDP? But also the question of a person called Aaron, how do you see Ukraine's external financing needs this year? And do you see investors in Central and Eastern Europe actually delaying investment plans until the war stops? And after that, we will talk about reconstruction issues. But let's first talk about those two.
So Ukraine, if you look at the map of Ukraine, the area where military activities are taking place produced about 60% of Ukrainian GDP. According to the government, between a third and half of firms stopped working. Electricity consumption, which is typically a good indicator for what's happening in the economy, is down by 40%. So,
Beata, can you explain this number? So the war, does this include the Kiev area, or because now the Russians are not in Kiev anymore, in the Kiev area, and I suppose a lot of the economic activities are in the Kiev area. Or is it the eastern and southern part that is?
I believe this was eastern and southern part, excluding Kiev, but perhaps take it with a grain of sand. But you know, basically, what the message is that the places where the war is taking place, these are the places which are generating a lot of income for the country.
Right.
Income is not being generated. Firms are not operating. Right? And then, you know, on top of this, you have millions of refugees inside as well as outside. And, you know, the government not collecting taxes, though it does intend to start doing that. Now, under fairly optimistic assumptions, which is, you know, some resolution of the conflict happening within 2 to 3 months, we were projecting drop in Ukrainian GDP of 20%. Now, at the moment, you know, besides the war, there are many challenges the government is facing. As the government rightly pointed out, you know, what's the point of winning the war if the functioning of the country collapses? They have big needs. They are operating, they are making payments, but they are not collecting taxes. So their needs are, I believe, at the order of $4 billion a month. That's the shortfall they are facing. And, you know, they are receiving transfers from abroad. Obviously, there is a need of, farmers to obtain financing to be able to sow. There is need to obtain financing to import energy and so on and so forth. So the situation is very difficult, but, you know, external help is coming.
And the external need, the external financing need, as you say, is quite substantial. And is your assessment that it is largely provided, or are there substantial gaps? And what about the infrastructure of financial assistance? I mean, my understanding is that the Ukrainian financial system is still largely operational. And so can you say a word about sort of more the operational side of providing financial assistance? Are there any bottlenecks in that respect?
So I'm not aware of major bottlenecks. I believe the government is accepting financial assistance in a central way, in a centralized way. I think this, you know, budget support is coming. And, you know, I think the speed at which international community has reacted to the war has been extremely impressive. And I think there is an understanding that it is absolutely vital to help the government function, to help the government provide basic services, make basic payments to its citizens. And that's something that is separate from, you know, any form of military assistance that the government may be receiving.
Okay, let's talk about the difficult issue of, and a bit hypothetical issue of reconstructing Ukraine. And reconstructing Ukraine is, of course, can be thought of under different scenarios. But let's take it in a scenario where the territorial integrity of Ukraine remains intact, is intact. And so the infrastructure would have to be rebuilt in the entire country. What is, and I think there's the question here that my colleagues are already putting up here. So who will actually cover the cost, but also perhaps how do you think about this, assessing the cost, and what are the sort of key principles you would put forward about the way we should be thinking about reconstructing Ukraine. For example, one topic that often comes up is, you know, now that a lot of infrastructure has been destroyed, should the new should the rebuilt infrastructure from the beginning be, for example, climate friendly, and how can we ensure that? So sort of give us your pitch on the reconstruction issue, even though it's unfortunately still quite hypothetical because the war is still in full swing, unfortunately.
So I think the best case scenario would be a situation where some form of resolution to the conflict is reached, and this resolution would be stable. Because obviously a situation with frozen conflict or conflict continuing on part of the territory of the country will create enormous uncertainty and will create enormous challenges for reconstruction of Ukraine. I would think about reconstruction in terms of three pillars. The first one is rebuilding physical capital stock. The second one is rebuilding or actually improving legal or institutional framework of the country. And the third one is rebuilding human capital. So rebuilding capital stock, right? The needs are large. I think a few weeks ago, the Ukrainian government assessed the damage to buildings and other physical infrastructure to be at the order of $100 billion. It's probably much larger now. That's, to put it into perspective, that's about two-thirds of Ukrainian pre-COVID GDP. I think rebuilding capital stock is perhaps the easiest, right? As long as you have donor money, and I think the international community is certainly willing and interested in stepping up. But in order to do that effectively and to leapfrog and to have a vision for for the future of Ukraine, you need the institutional framework. And, you know, it's no secret that the institutional framework in the pre-war Ukraine was lacking. And you know, to me, the best hope for the future of Ukraine is EU membership. I mean, this is what it's the membership, it's the accession process, right? And, you know, the experience of Eastern Europe teaches us that the reforms are painful. The reforms create a lot of uncertainty. They create winners and losers. And it's incredibly difficult for any government to commit to long-term reforms given short electoral cycles. So you need an external anchor, an external commitment device. And the success of Eastern Europe during transition was due to the fact that the direction of the reforms was locked through the EU accession process. So if Ukraine can use the prospect, even a distant prospect of EU membership, that would certainly give the direction to the reforms and lock in the process. Because I think finding consensus on the direction of the reform is half of the work.
No, I mean, this institutional point, if I may say so, and interrupt you there, I think it's absolutely crucial. I mean, it's well known, as you say, that the institutional quality pre-war in Ukraine was suboptimal. And I think it's also clear that reform processes can be greatly helped by having external anchors. Now, whether EU membership will be the anchor that credibly governments will be able to commit to on the western part of Europe, I think is a big question mark, at least on it. And we know that referenda on Ukrainian membership, etc., have been already rejecting that membership, I think, in the Netherlands. So this is certainly, I would say, the most ambitious external anchoring strategy. I think when we think about this issue, we should really think also about perhaps less ambitious but also very effective anchoring mechanisms. And you know, I'm wondering to what extent the assistance that will have to be given for the rebuilding of the physical capital stock can be used as a mechanism to ensure this sort of institutional improvement. And then I want to ask you about the human capital, because you mentioned that point. I think it's absolutely crucial. But perhaps just one more point on this institution point.
So you are absolutely right that, you know, securing prospects of EU membership would not be a walk in the park. And, you know, as we all know, there has been accession or expansion fatigue in the EU. And there are other, though less effective, ways of doing that. Now, certainly the fact that Ukraine has a free trade agreement with the EU is a big help, because we know that poorer countries benefit enormously from access to richer country markets. But and certainly conditionality as attached to international aid flows could help. But that would require greater coordination on the part of the donors, and that would require finding a process that would create buy-in within Ukraine. Because it's not just about piecemeal reforms here in various areas, it's about a vision for the country, for the future, that steers the reform in a comprehensive manner. And that's much harder to achieve through donor support coming from various institutions.
Okay, so let's talk about the human capital side, which is, of course, extremely important, because as you mentioned, Ukraine has already suffered from many refugees leaving the country, which is good news in a sense, because they are out of the war zone. But of course, one will have to think about getting refugees back, so that human capital also comes back. But then there's also, of course, training needs within the country. So how do you see really the human capital challenge, given this huge refugee phenomena, and also the traumas and the, psychological problems that this war leaves on individuals? I mean, this goes well beyond the refugees. I mean, anybody who has been in a war zone will be marked probably for life by that experience, with consequences, of course, for not only happiness but also economic activity. And we are talking here among economists, so we're always putting the economic angle there, but of course it goes well beyond the economics, the issues. So what's your human capital take?
So I think rebuilding of capital of physical infrastructure and in institutional infrastructure are preconditions for bringing some of the refugees back, right? Unless we see a clear direction in which the country is going, many of them may not be interested to return. And, you know, sadly, the longer the war lasts, the lesser the chance that some of these people will return. But of course, there is a benefit of them being out of the war zone. That's obviously a huge issue. But I think there's also a benefit of seeing how other countries what kind of level of incomes they have. There is hopefully some knowledge, some understanding of and some incentive perhaps to introduce similar reforms in their own country that some of these refugees will bring. You mentioned the trauma that people experience, and academic studies show that refugees have worse health outcomes long-term, but they also show an interesting pattern. Their children and their grandchildren tend to invest more in education, because education is something you can take with you while material goods get lost. So in that sense, there will be an incentive to invest in education. Now, many refugees, what we also see are typically younger people, more entrepreneurial people, educated people, because often you need resources to leave the country. It is a human capital loss. Now, some of them will not come back, but what we also know from academic literature is that migrants create networks. They serve as a bridge between their old country and their new country, and they stimulate flows of international trade and investment. So in that sense, the fact that some of the refugees will not come back, I would hope it would foster economic links between post-war Ukraine and the countries where they went. And I think these economic links and investment that refugees and remittances that they would send would also help rebuild the country.
So I'm conscious of the time, and I think we are getting close to the end. But if I may, I want to ask two more quick questions, and I promise they are quick. And just to do justice to our very active audience that is asking us questions. So one question was on the tourism sector and how the tourism sector is affected by all of this. And perhaps you can just give us a few words on that. And the final question is a more political one, which is by Dieter Strobans, who's asking you about what's your take on Guy Verhofstadt's claim that sanctions on Russia are not effective enough, and we need stronger sanctions. And I think there is a parallel question on the head of the central bank. He's also asking that the head of the central bank of Russia, on the other hand, is depicting a rather gloomy picture to the Duma last week. And you know, how do you expect this to put pressure on Russia? So a few words on the sanctions. And you know, I know that you are from Polish origin, and I guess you have your views, but I guess we want to hear your views as an academic here on the sanction regime and you know, whether it's gloomy enough or whether it needs more gloom for Russia to make a difference politically. But let's start with the easy one, the tourism one.
So some countries, such as Cyprus, Montenegro, Armenia, Estonia, rely to a large extent on Russian tourism. Spending of Russian tourists there amounts to between 1 and 2% of percentage points of GDP. So this is huge loss to these countries not to be able to host Russian tourists. On top of that, the tourism industry is affected by general uncertainty. You know, I am speaking to you from Krakow, Poland, where at this time of the year, you would expect to see quite a substantial number of tourism. The numbers are lower than usual, and you hear a lot of anecdotal evidence of foreign tour companies canceling package tours because Poland is too close to the war zone. So this uncertainty, this concern about military activities is spilling to many countries in the region. And, you know, it's worth remembering that emerging markets tend to host more tourists than tourists they send abroad. So even if all locals stayed at home for this summer's tourist season, they wouldn't be able to replace the lost revenues. We also know that foreign tourists spend much more than domestic tourists. So, you know, some of those revenues will be permanently lost this year. And, you know, that's already on top of the tourism industry that has been affected very strongly by COVID. On sanctions, you know, are sanctions working? Should they be working better? Well, you know, it's relative to what, right? If you think about sanctions that were introduced after annexation of Crimea, the cost of those sanctions was below 1% of GDP. If you look at what these sanctions did to Russian exports, they lowered exports by about 7.5 percentage points. So their effects were smaller. The current sanctions are much more comprehensive, have much larger effect, as for instance, reflected in our GDP projection of minus 10%. Could we do more? Certainly we could, by not purchasing hydrocarbons, by not purchasing natural gas from Russia. And, you know, not buying natural gas would be particularly painful to Russia because it's much harder to redirect gas exports than it is to redirect oil or coal exports. But this would be equally, if not more, painful to the countries engaging in sanctions. So, you know, sanctions are a difficult question because Russia is not a democracy. So, how, you know, to what extent these sanctions put pressure on Mr. Putin, it's unknowable, at least for me. But, you know, I certainly hope that, you know, governments of Western democracies will continue putting pressure on the regime.
Berta, thank you so much for your time today. It was really a fascinating tour d'horizon, a fascinating discussion, and I learned so much. And I hope that also, I'm sure our audience also found it very interesting, judging by the number of questions that were asked. Thank you for being available and for, you know, providing so many insights and doing such a great work at the EBRD. Thank you again and all the best.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.